Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Girl with Three Birthdays, an adopted daughter's memoir of tiaras, tough truths, and tall tales, by Patty Eddington, narrated by Rosemary Benson. Preface. A memoir is a story told from one person's perspective based on that person's memories. As a journalist, it was difficult for me at times to tell just one side of this story, mine, and I often asked for opinions on these events from others. In almost all cases, I allowed those I talk about to read what I wrote. For that reason, it was unnecessary for me to change many names. I did change the identities of a few people to protect their families. It was a difficult decision for my editors and myself to reproduce the excerpts from the report of investigation verbatim, with errors, inconsistent abbreviations, and strike-throughs, but we ultimately did to allow the listener to experience the document exactly as I did when it fell from that manila envelope. It had been created by a busy court worker on a manual typewriter several years before whiteout was invented. In the report, I am referred to as both Marianne, which was my birth name, and Patty. Chapter 1. Here's the thing about the truth. For more than 15 years, I believed the tale I was told by an older half-sister I didn't meet until I was in my 40s. She said I became a ward of the court at only 3 days old. I was living with my biological mother, Lois, and four siblings in an unheated garage with no plumbing when a social worker came, banged on our rickety door, and took me away. I ran after the car and kicked the tires and cried, "Give us back our baby," said my sister, who was a little girl of only 10 at the time. I'm sure that's what she remembered. I know that's what she believed. But recently, a decade and a half after I first heard that story, a newly discovered aunt, the sister of my biological father, told me there had been a knock on her family's door, and when they answered, Lois thrust me, wrapped in a soiled and frayed blanket and possibly slightly injured, into their arms and said, "Here, if you want her, you can have her." It was easy to imagine a poignant scene. Lois setting out on her journey on a winter night in 1960, dressed maybe in a threadbare coat and a babushka, carrying me across broken sidewalks, passing the homes of happier families who sat in the white glow of their living room televisions and watched the Huntley-Brinkley Report or 77 Sunset Strip. Except when I asked my new aunt for the address of the home where her family was living at the time and did a Google Earth search, I found it was far outside of the town. Lois couldn't have walked. This is my story, and I've tried to tell the truth. But I've learned the truth is malleable. We all want to tell either the prettiest or maybe sometimes the most grotesque of tales. The other thing I've learned can affect the truth greatly, the passage of time. Time, I've come to find, is very, very good at deception. It is almost as good as people. Chapter 2. Beauty Lesson. The realization hit after I'd spent decades parroting the only story I knew. When understanding finally dawned, I lurched on the heated table violently. Jackie, the lash extension lady hovering 6 inches above my upside-down face, could have dropped her pointy tweezers in my eye. I'd been describing the first photograph of me in my childhood photo album. I wore a stiffly starched dress, ruffled anklets, and tiny orthopedic shoes. Our collie mix, Joe, rested at my feet at the base of the towering maple tree in front of our old farmhouse. It was 1961, so the photo was black and white. I knew, because my mother later told me, my tightly curled halo of hair was tinted red, the result of a tonette perm and a henna rinse. I was only 20 months old, but Mom, a beautician with a head full of bottle blonde cotton candy curls, said the ministrations were necessary. She said I'd been maltreated in the foster home where I first lived after I'd been given up for adoption. Your hair was so fine and lifeless, I decided to cut it all off and give you some color and body, she said. It made sense. After many years of foster kids and a previously failed adoption attempt, Mom was hopeful she might soon have her own little forever kid, and she'd want me to be as fashionable as she was. That story was normally part of my repertoire when describing my stubborn, eccentric, overprotective mother. Sometimes I switched it out with the tale of the time she gave 10-year-old me a sex ed talk while driving to church, or the incident when she grabbed one of her misbehaving chickens around the neck and tossed it in the outhouse to give it time to settle down. My stories about Millie were always sweetly received, which is exactly what I wanted. As much as I loved her, I knew she often needed some good PR. It was easier telling stories about my dad, who was bald, handsome, sweet-natured, generous, and funny. He was always plowing the driveways of the widows on our road, or scooping up coleslaw for the Friday Night Lions Club fish fry, or transporting human eyes in a cooler from the big hospital in Lansing to the eye bank in Ann Arbor. I know the last sounds odd, but in the 1970s, it was allowed. Dad would go to a hospital in Lansing or Flint, pick up a carefully wrapped, shoebox-sized parcel packed into a cooler with ice bags, and drive it an hour and a half to the destination. He did this after a 5 a.m. wake-up call and 8-hour workday, getting home at 8 to 9 p.m., going to bed, and starting all over again. Mom was a harder sell. My older cousins remembered her smacking their knuckles with a butter knife if their table manners were lacking. They were always lacking, by the way. She was a big city transplant, opinionated and outspoken, politically minded, a take-no-prisoners, larger-than-life personality who landed in the cornfields of mid-Michigan in 1950 after marrying my father. Noting Mom's peplum suits, French manicures, Lana Turner pompadour, and weighing the vast differences between her liberal Protestant daughter and conservative Catholic son-in-law, my grandmother told Mom she'd see her back in Detroit within 12 months. Accepting the challenge, our 5'2" firebrand pulled on some overalls, shoveled chicken shit, and lived amid those cornfields for the next 57 years, never forgetting her red Max Factor lipstick. My stories about Millie were meant to soften the hard edges, show her truly charming side, and entice everyone else into loving her as much as I did. Even though decades had passed, and my eyelash lady worked in an upscale salon in our Lake Michigan resort town, while Mom practiced her beauty treatments in a damp laundry room overlooking a cow pasture, I thought Jackie might get a kick out of the perm and henna on a toddler story. She did. But just like the time people laughed at what I thought was a poignant moment during a eulogy I was giving, her response was something I'd never considered. "Oh, I get it," Jackie said. "You were in disguise." Chapter 3. A Pretty Dress and Probate Court. Cork Road, just outside the rural town of Morris, population just over 1,000 even today, was heavily settled by followers of the Catholic faith. They had immigrated from Ireland during the potato famine of the 1840s, apparently traveling from Ellis Island to plop down in the middle of the Michigan mitten. In the 1960s, there were just 5 homes at the far end of our dirt road. It originated about 8 miles south and meandered through corn and wheat fields, crossing 3 paved, 2-lane roads until it ran into I-69 at the turnaround near the house where I grew up. In summer, wildflowers grew tall against fading barns and roadside silos, and beautiful orange and black orioles, so abundant the high school mascot was the oriole, flitted along the fence rows. A pair of grandparents lived closest to the turnaround in a peeling farmhouse. But younger families resided in the other homes, which were also old and juxtaposed oddly with my family's new, modern red brick ranch. There were 8 parents in those 4 houses, dads who worked on their farms or in a factory, and moms who cooked and cleaned and hung laundry on clotheslines, until I reached high school, when the number fell to 6 after 2 scandalous, messy divorces. There were also 20 kids under those few roofs, aged infant to surly teenager. An average of 5 children for 4 homes may already seem like a lot, but consider this. I was an only child. The other 3 families were more than doing their part to populate the countryside. My neighbor kids got up at 5 a.m. to tend to their cows, played horse with a mostly deflated ball and a rusty hoop without a net, drank milk out of the carton while standing in front of the open refrigerator, and ate butter and sugar sandwiches on gooey white Wonder Bread for lunch. They were athletic and wiry and free, sunburned and beautiful in a scraped-up knee, tangled-hair, country kid kind of way. I was a pudgy, nearsighted bookworm with perennially misbuttoned shirts, parents who cared too much, an insatiable reading habit, and a tendency to be dramatic. When I was 8, my mother told me to gather my shorts and sleeveless tops and begin packing my pink plastic suitcase for a spring break trip to Florida. She found me, instead, perched on the corner of my chenille-covered double bed, staring into our apple orchard and tearfully waving goodbye to our herd of beef cattle. It wasn't a cheery, "See you in 10 days, dear cow friends," goodbye, but more of a, "I'm sure we're going to die in a horrific crash with a semi-truck carrying a load of head lettuce, and you'll be shipped off to be served as steak even sooner," forlorn wave. Mom reminded me of 2 things. Dad was a very good driver, and I always overreacted. Ironically, I was mimicking her own over-the-top behaviors and eccentricities. One example was Millie's church attire, which was frequently a mink stole with her monogram stitched in script on the creamy, taupe satin lining. She'd purchased it as a young woman while she worked at Hudson's department store in downtown Detroit, and it was her prized possession. Perched high atop her platinum curls, she balanced a burnt orange felt hat with a large pheasant feather on the right side. She wore the combo almost every Sunday in the fall as she and I headed off the 14 miles on country roads in our latest Oldsmobile 88. The make and model were my father's passion, and he bought a new one every year. We were going to St. John's United Church of Christ in the big city of Owosso. Dad had already attended Mass at St. Mary's in Uptown Morris, then had his fill of buttermilk pancakes, maple syrup, and bacon, and settled into his maroon brushed velvet Lazy Boy recliner with the Detroit Free Press. I loved Mom's hat, but it was also a trauma whenever she wore it, because she would instruct me to turn the car visor against my passenger side window so some dumb hunter doesn't mistake me for a bird and shoot me in the head. She also showed me how to take control of the steering wheel and gently ease the car to the side of the road in case she ever had a coronary while driving. She'd been diagnosed with an enlarged heart as a child and sent to a special fresh air school, where she was fed porridge and made to sit outdoors in the sunshine to stay healthy. While her condition didn't seem to instill much caution during her daredevil childhood years, as she aged, she apparently began to live in fear one day her heart would sputter to a stop while alone with me in the car. Millie couldn't pass on her small, delicate hands or infectious laugh, but clearly she tutored me well in drama. So it's not surprising when I parked outside the 116-year-old Shiawassee County Courthouse and clicked my key fob on a frigid Friday in January 2020, the monologue swirling in my head was passionate and overly theatrical. Here I am, about to walk up the same steps Mom and Dad took when they finalized my adoption. The same steps Lois took when the judge rescinded her maternal rights. Of course, it's possible Lois wasn't even in the room as I became a ward of the court in December 1960, when I was only 13 months old, or maybe 14, depending on which of my birth certificates you choose to believe. It is likely she was not there. From what I was learning, jurisdiction over her five children didn't seem to be a priority with my biological mother. Whatever happened, I thought, taking a moment to admire the sweeping majesty of the courthouse and its towering cupola, this building played probably the most integral role of any building in my life. The gray-haired sheriff's deputy, who put my cell phone in a tiny locker and my purse through the metal detector, was so kind and solicitous, I almost blurted out, "I'm here to see if I can get my adoption record unsealed and find out what in the actual hell happened way back then." "Where can I direct you, ma'am?" "Probate court, please." "Oh," he said sympathetically, "you're in the wrong place." Of course I was. Why would this visit be any less a red herring than the rest of the twisty, disturbing story I'd begun patching together? I slogged back to my car to head across the big parking lot to the correct building and thought about driving on to find a cup of coffee or a good bookstore, finally putting my past in the past. The few friends and relatives I'd told about this quest had looked concerned and gently asked me why, and especially, why now, after all this time? For years, I'd been telling them I had no interest in finding out what happened during the first 20 months of my life. That had all changed, though, with the results of a simple DNA spit test I'd received as a gift from my daughter, and the look in my new Aunt Ava's eyes when we met, not even 2 years earlier. After all those decades in denial, I'd tapped into the Human Genome Project, sent off a vial filled with my saliva, and a couple months later opened an email that unfurled decades of mystery, answering a few questions, but posing many more. Just 2 weeks after receiving my results, I sat beside my diminutive, newly discovered aunt at a quinceañera as she hugged me, patted my cheek, and stroked my arm. "You were living with me and my sister Jane and her husband Cecil in the house they bought because we were all going to be a family, honey. But one day Jane dressed you up in your pretty dress and put a bow in your hair. I said, 'Where are you taking our baby? Where are you taking Mary?'" Aunt Ava's eyes misted. "And Jane said, We have to take Mary to see a judge, but when we come home, she will be ours forever and ever. But then, we never saw you again. Chapter 4. Like Jagged Confetti. Once they decided to adopt, it took a very long time for my parents to find a child. By then, they were almost as old as the grandparents of most of my friends. Mom was 48 and Dad 45 when I started kindergarten. I don't remember being told I was adopted. It was just something I always knew. "We chose you because you were the cutest little girl in the cabbage patch," my mother would say, which, of course, made me feel happy and special. My adoptee status was something I wore like my cozy pink Angora sweater. It was as much a part of my persona as my dark brown, wavy, and unruly hair. But it wasn't something I ever imagined anyone else would give a damn about. Then, one Friday at recess in the sixth grade, I sat on a swing next to a classmate I'd never played with before. Dragging our white kids in the dirt, I told her how excited I was for my Uncle Frank's wedding the next day. At 60, my father's previously unmarried older brother had found the love of a no-nonsense, devout Catholic woman named Margaret, who resembled the photos I'd seen in the Encyclopedia Britannica of Eleanor Roosevelt. There would be a rehearsal dinner that night, and then we would go out to dinner at a fancy seafood restaurant where I would be allowed to order butterfly shrimp and a kitty cocktail instead of my usual burger basket with fries and chocolate milk. I had a new cotton mini dress in a psychedelic orange and pink paisley print and a matching over-the-shoulder cloth purse with a gold-toned chain for the wedding. That trendy dress, playing with the most popular girl in school, I didn't think I'd ever been happier. "It all sounds so fun," she said. "You know, I actually really like you. You're very nice." "You're nice, too," I replied giddily. "My mother told me never to play with you, though," she added, beginning to pump her swing high. "She said you don't live with your real parents." My heart beat faster. I felt my cheeks redden, and I ran off the playground and through the long school hallway to the restroom, slammed the door to a stall, sat on the toilet seat, and scrunched my knees to my chest. People, adult people, were talking about me in their homes. My throat tightened, but I didn't cry. I knew I hadn't done anything wrong, but I was still embarrassed. Years later, I realized what I was really feeling as I hid in the bathroom stall until the teacher sent a classmate to look for me. Shame. I was only 11, but I already understood it would be painful to my parents if I tried to delve into my origins. So I began to stuff down my natural curiosity. Like virtually all adoptions of the time, mine was closed. The details of my biological family were intended to remain forever a secret, which I decided was just fine with me. I told myself I had no curiosity about anything before the photo with Joe the dog in front of the old maple. For decades, it remained that way. If someone asked if I knew who my real parents were, I would reply, "Absolutely," cock an eyebrow, narrow my eyes, and glare until they began to sputter their apologies. When I was 24 and working at one of my first jobs as a journalist at the Holland Sentinel in western Michigan, an Associated Press reporter I knew named Linda, also an adoptee, asked if she could interview me for a series she was writing on the topic. Linda was probably 10 years older, hard-nosed, brittle, and completely nonplussed by my insistence I had no real curiosity about my earliest days. For every adopted kid, The first thing that ever happened to them is they were rejected. And I can't believe you don't have more questions about where you came from, she groused. I insisted I didn't. Even though I knew some of those closest to me were fascinated and couldn't understand how I didn't want to unravel the mystery. It was during the same stint at the Sentinel where I met the woman who would become my surrogate sister, the free-spirited Thelma to my cautious Louise, my best friend, Kristen. My high school boyfriend, Jim, and I had gotten married in 1981, while we were still college students at Michigan State University. I had just one more year to go in my undergrad journalism program, and Jim had two more years left in veterinary school. We spent the next couple years finishing our education, then working at poorly paid and unfulfilling first jobs. I worked at two small weekly newspapers, and he worked for a blousy, cartoonish Ann Arbor veterinarian who warned Jim after a barbecue held to welcome him to never bring me into her clinic when she wasn't there because she might steal something. I'd been accused of being an ice queen, reserved, and a Pollyanna, but no one had ever said I looked like a thief. Her distrust of me was the least of her offenses. Jim suffered and struggled along for 7 months before accepting an offer in January 1984 to work as an equine vet for a large practice outside of Grand Rapids. I landed the job at the Holland paper, about 40 minutes away near the shores of Lake Michigan. A few weeks earlier, I'd traveled to the lakeshore for my interview from a friend's apartment in downtown Grand Rapids, but by the time I started work, we'd rented a condo in the suburbs on the opposite side of the city. Remember, Siri didn't exist in 1984. Just go the same way you drove when you went for the interview, Jim told me. Jim is a brilliant human and normally gives great advice. Don't mix your liquors, was one nugget I'd learned to respect very much, for example. But as a young man, he disdained consulting a map or asking for directions. I once followed him around downtown Lansing for an hour, searching for a mechanic located approximately 5 minutes from our tiny apartment. Still, I was 24 and very in love, and apparently even more stupid. I did listen to him and backtracked miles out of my way to get on the same highway I'd used before and ended up 15 minutes late for my first day on the job. I'd worn cheap high heels, a polyester suit, and fake pearls, and as I slipped and slid across the icy parking lot, I looked up to see a petite blonde with a pixie haircut and wearing an old bellboy's jacket and jeans hurrying in late as well. She gave me a huge welcoming smile and told me she'd been on the job as a photojournalist for exactly 1 week. Since she was also tardy, I felt a little better about being late. Kristen was a joyous sprite who fit easily into the punk rock era of the mid-1980s. She was extraordinarily beautiful and fun-loving, her huge brown eyes often rimmed in kohl. She wore oversized men's wool coats and funky outfits she put together from thrift store finds, and there was often a clove cigarette in her hand. Her shorn hair was sometimes spiked and occasionally rainbow-hued. She drove a little shell-pink Toyota Corolla, adorned with Dead Kennedys and Violent Femmes bumper stickers, and was the object of much swooning from many of the men in the newsroom, and likely a few of the women. We worked well on assignments together, but she seemed too cool for me and way out of my friend league. When I first arrived at the Sentinel, I'd tried to forge an alliance with a nice, slightly built, very pale fellow reporter about my age named Kathy. I invited her to Grand Rapids one Saturday afternoon for shopping and lunch, but she was allergic to all makeup, most fabrics, and many foods. It was a long, stilted, forced afternoon. I thought about trying again, but as I was about to stop and ask her to grab a bite one day, I saw her desk was covered in discarded tissues, severe allergies, and decided to take myself out for a tuna melt sandwich at Big
Sample complete. Ready to continue?